If you listen regularly, you'll know that home, the idea of home and what it means, is something we keep coming back to on Life Matters. It preoccupies Geraldine Brooks as well. The expatriate author and journalist, as I'm sure you've heard, will give this year's Boyer Lecture Series here on Radio National, and that series is called The Idea of Home. It's not surprising when you realise that she's lived overseas for most of the last 30 years and that home, that place, is integral to her latest novel, Caleb's Crossing. Geraldine Brooks is with me in the studio. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
Now, this is a story, this novel, it's a story of two places, Martha's Vineyard and Cambridge, Massachusetts, where Harvard is. And both of them you know well.
Yes, I spent a year at Harvard as a Radcliffe Fellow in 2005-2006. And from Cambridge, we moved to Martha's Vineyard, which is where we're living now.
Mm. Parts of the book read like a love letter to your adopted home. Bethia, whose point of view is the one we have in it, discovers more and more about the island and falls more and more in love with it. That's you, isn't it?
It is, to a very large extent. It is a remarkably beautiful place. And it's about 100 square miles, whatever that is in real money.
Mm.
But it's a very, very diverse collection of biomes and ecosystems. And as much as you think that you know the island well, there's always something else wonderful to discover.
Mm. And later, when she's at Harvard, she misses the place almost as much, almost more than she misses the people.
I think that she does, because Cambridge in the 1660s was a pretty squalid little settlement. It had been built with the houses all clustered closely together because in the 1630s the British were very afraid of the French and they were fearing an attack. And they hadn't understood how the water flowed and where the fens were, so they basically built on a swamp and it was very ill-drained and people had no idea about proper hygiene, so they just tipped their slops into the creek, which was brackish to begin with and then became quite polluted. So she's going from this place that is pristine and bountiful into a settlement which for its day would have been very urban to her.
Yes, and grotty, basically.
Grotty, indeed.
And what about you? When you're away from the island, cause I know you visited it for many years, over decades really, and the last, what, 5 or 6 years is where you live. Do you miss it when you're away?
It depends where I'm away too. I don't miss it so much when I'm home in Sydney. But I do feel that it takes a forklift to get me off the island to go to what we call America. The old islanders actually really do say that when they're getting on the ferry. They say, I'm going to America today.
It's not that far, though, it really
is. 7 miles.
7 miles. It's nothing. I mean, you're that far from Manly in Sydney now, essentially.
Yeah, it's just, it's very different, though. The island has been an ornery and individualistic place, I think, from the get-go. The Wampanoag of the island are very different to the Wampanoag of the mainland.
This is the Native American people.
Indeed, yeah. And the place, they used to call it, one of the names that they had for the island was Kapawak, which means place of sanctuary. And they would take people who had run into strife on the mainland into tribal wars or whatever, people who were on the run. And then later, during the whaling era, they offered refuge to escaping slaves. So this idea that it's a place that you run to and it's an escape from the world is still a very real one.
Mm. The germ of the idea for this all was a real person, the first Native American to graduate from Harvard almost 350 years ago.
1665
yeah.
was the date of his graduation. And when I saw that, it absolutely astonished me. I'm thinking this is more than 100 years before the white history of Australia begins. And already there's Harvard, which was a surprise to me in itself. And there's a young Native American who has been born and raised in his own language and culture, who manages to master Latin and Greek, which was the requirement for matriculation to Harvard College, and sits down with the sons of the Puritan colonial elite And how did that happen and what was it like?
In the story, there's this range of opinions about this as an idea, about whether it's right or whether it's good to educate a savage.
I think that the Puritans were educated people who believed in education by their own lights. They had lots of ideas about who needed to know what, but there was a very strong pressure to evangelize the Native American population, and it was one of the few ways that they could get money out of English donors was if they said that they were going to use this money to further the cause of Christianization, because the English donors were very keen on this project and were dismayed at how slowly it was going in the colonies.
Yes. Interestingly, there's less range of opinion on how much education Bathia can have.
Women, the good wife was supposed to know how to read so she could read her Bible. Anything beyond that was highly questionable. It was thought that excessive education would addle a woman's wits, that her brain wasn't formed for the higher learnings, that it would be a misfortune to send her off to her husband in a position to find fault with his arguments because a husband must be the head of the house.
It's interesting that Bathia's father, who's obviously a good man and clearly an intelligent man, even he, first of all, he's pleased and proud that she's clearly so quick. But then, of course, he decides that he's not happy about this.
It causes stress in the family. He's trying to educate Bathia's older brother to prepare him to go to Harvard to become a minister in his turn. But in my imaginary scenario, Makepeace has dyslexia, which, of course, nobody knows about. But he finds it a struggle, a great struggle to learn Latin and particularly Greek and the Hebrew alphabet, which is going in a whole other direction. And the poor young man is really flailing, whereas his sister is a quick study. And just as she overhears the lessons, as she's going about her chores at the loom or in the kitchen or baking bread, she's picking up things that Makepeace struggles with.
It's acquired by eavesdropping, and I nearly said accidental, but there's nothing accidental about it. She's extremely deliberate and determined about this.
She seeks knowledge, and she's prepared to take it where she finds it, no matter what risk. And that is what unites her with Caleb, the young Wampanoag son of a Songkhem or chieftain, who she meets by chance when they're both children. And they have nothing in common.
No, except a quick intelligence.
Ideas about God are completely different. Ideas about how you live a good life. The idea of sin is foreign to him. It obsesses her. And yet they have this one thing in common, which is that they're both hungry for learning. Mm. And they'll both do anything to get it.
There is not much recorded of women's lives of that time. Was it difficult to get inside her head?
There are things recorded of women's lives, but not by women. Because of this educational philosophy, women weren't necessarily even taught to write, because writing is a skill that you need to communicate with the external world. And why would a good wife need that? She needs to. Her concern is with her family. She doesn't need to write. So it was unusual for women to be skillful at writing. Paper was a luxury. And they didn't have time. Their workload was unbelievable.
Actually, that is really well illustrated, and I had never thought of it. But, I mean, when she's at home looking after her brother and her father after her mother dies, she's just constantly doing stuff. She gets up early and she keeps going.
To keep people fed and clothed meant, you know, you raised the sheep, you sheared the sheep, you spun the wool, you made the cloth, you made the clothing, you washed the clothing, you had to draw the water to wash the clothing, you had to make the soap to wash the clothing. Everything that you needed, you did for yourself, and most of those tasks fell to women. So there are no women's journals before 1700.
They didn't have time.
And there are no good ones till 1750, which is 100 years later than my period. So I had to look in unconventional places to find women speaking in their own voice.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Geraldine Brooks, the author and journalist. We're talking about the work she traverses in her latest novel, Caleb's Crossing, and as you'll be aware, actually, later this year, she'll be giving the Boyer Lectures on the idea of home, and home is at the heart of this novel. Another thing, of course, at the heart of it is the power of education, the doors it opens, and who's allowed to have it.
It is the great divide. It's interesting, you know, I think that my view of the Puritans was a fuzzy sort of image of people in silly hats and ridiculous shoes, thumping the Bible, formed very much by bad movies like A Scarlet Letter. And actually, they're much more interesting than that. And embarking on this novel and trying to put myself into that Calvinist mindset was a great challenge, but it was also very confronting because these were a very thoughtful, very committed group of people. But they lived with this powerful uncertainty, this gut-wrenching uncertainty, because they believed that God had already decided who was saved and who was not. And nothing you could do in your life would change that. And you just had to hope that at some point God would let you know.
Right.
That you were saved.
You could have a rational response to that and just have a tremendous time and be completely selfish, couldn't you?
Well, I did find something on the record, and one place I looked for women's voices was in court cases, and this really struck me. A woman had done a terrible thing. She'd thrown her own child down a well, and she said the great good that had come out of this was that she finally knew she was damned.
Right.
And she didn't have to worry about it anymore.
The book is dedicated to your son, your adopted son, Bizarre, who also made a crossing, you make the point. Why did you do that?
I was writing this book at the time that we brought Bizayo home from Ethiopia. He was 5 years old at the time, and he didn't speak any English. He did speak three Ethiopian languages, however. And watching him acquire English with this speed and avidity and hunger gave me a great confidence in allowing Bethiah and Caleb to acquire each other's language, because the motivation clearly was there for Bizayo and it was there for Bethiah in my imagination as well. So instead of stumbling around and thinking, well, you know, how long would this take? My son learned English fluently in 3 months.
It's astonishing, isn't it? And it shows the plasticity of the child's mind.
It certainly does, yeah.
I mean, despite your efforts, though, have there been moments of difficulty to move from one place and a culture to a very different one?
I think for him it must have been like being kidnapped by aliens and shot into outer space.
Nice aliens who looked after him.
But still, it was a complete change, but he is an incredibly resilient child and bright and joyful and affectionate, and we feel like he's been part of our family forever now. And my only struggle is actually fending off, you know, his desire to embrace the crappiest, junkiest American pop culture. I'll be hitting the ABC store and getting a bunch of more suitable DVDs to take home.
that is clearly deep within human DNA, that desire for junk food and junk culture. And of course, he has an older brother, so he has someone else to interact with apart from you and your husband at home.
Yes, my older son Nathaniel actually was very much the driver of the train for this adoption, because he longed for a brother. And so they're very funny now. It's a typical younger brother older brother relationship.
Yes.
For better and for worse.
I longed for a younger brother. I got four younger sisters. It just never seemed fair. I'm very pleased with them now. Caleb is torn between the two worlds, and it's something about his age when he encounters this other world, whereas Bizarre is clearly going to grow up an American boy.
Yes, he will. Yeah, and an Australian boy, I hope.
Right. Well, actually, do you still feel, after really the best part of 30 years, because you went off to Columbia School of Journalism in about 1982 or 83.
Yeah, but I was back here for, you know, big swathes of time. I don't think of myself as an expatriate as much as an oscillator, really.
Oh, right.
We were able to be back here for 4 years, a year here, a year there, and then for at least 4 months every year when my older son was in primary school. And he had two homes and two schools and two sets of friends, and he would transfer between them effortlessly, and he looks back on that time very fondly, and he has a very strong sense of himself as an Australian.
Mm.
Now he's in high school, we can't do that anymore.
No.
So, you know, the music stopped and we were there. And so for the last 3 or 4 years, we've been very much living full-time in America. But that's really the first time that that's been true for us. And I hope that when he goes off to college, we'll be able to go back to oscillating until Bizu hits high school.
So you'll talk a lot more about this later in the year when you do the lectures. But home, where is home for you then?
It will always be Sydney, I think. I'm very strongly attuned to the humour, the light, the way the rocks poke up out of the soil in that wonderfully spare Sydney way, the look of the trees. All of these things are so deeply impressed in my DNA, I think. I have discovered something about myself in the last 3 or 4 years living on Martha's Vineyard, which is that I'm not as much of a city person as I thought I was.
Ah.
I love the very small town rural life that I have on the vineyard. I love being that close to nature, so that when I get up in the morning and walk through the wet grass, I can catch the otters cavorting on the side of the pond. And these kind of things are very uplifting to me. So, you know, maybe my destiny in Australia will be Flinders Island and not Sydney after all.
Just on home, though, because in Newport on Sydney's northern beaches, there's a house once owned by your parents, which was demolished recently, and you felt strongly enough to protest about that, even though you're mostly on the other side of the world.
I just felt that it's not for me to say, but the point that I was making is that the people of the peninsula need to decide if they're going to go concrete boundary to boundary with great big houses and take out all the wonderful angophora trees that flourish there, and all the space for the birds and for just breathing freely that the old, simple, modest beach houses represented. And it's a choice that's going to have to be made sooner or later. Wasn't made soon enough for my mum and dad's old house, which was one of the oldest houses in Newport.
Mm.
And it was a classic, simple, modest beach house. And it's being replaced by a gigantic two-family and one-apartment mansion. And I don't think there'll be any of the trees left that we planted or the banksias that gave that beach house its original name. And I just think that it's a decision that people need to make if there are things that we do want to keep, that keep the character that we love about a place.
I want to finish on Caleb, because this year I understand the first Martha's Vineyard Native American since him will finish her undergraduate
degree. She did. She graduated last Thursday. I was there. It was marvelous. And Harvard actually used the occasion of her graduation to right a great historic wrong, because Caleb had a fellow Wampanoag student who went through the prep school experience with him, who went to college with him, who completed all the arduous requirements of the 4-year arts degree, but was tragically murdered on his way back to the commencement ceremony.
He is in the story, of course.
He is in the story, and Harvard gave him a posthumous degree last Thursday.
He would have been valedictorian, wouldn't he?
There's some evidence that he may well have been, yes. He was a gifted student, yes. And that was a class that included the former governor's son and all of the luminaries of the Puritan colony. But he had excelled at his studies. So it's the oldest posthumous degree that's ever been awarded.
That's a good point to wrap this up. It's been great to have you here, and you've given us a lot to think about.
Thank you for having me.
That's Geraldine Brooks, who is, of course, a journalist and author, and her latest novel, Caleb's Crossing, is published by HarperCollins, and you will hear a lot more from Geraldine later in the year when she delivers the 2011 Boyer Lecture Series, The Idea of Home. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Richard Adie.